Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, I'm very happy to have Sarita Carroll with me. She was born in 1968, and she spent her formative years constantly on the move with her mother, a young hippie, in search of spiritual meaning. At just 9 years old, what was intended to be a brief summer trip to India took a very unexpected turn. Sarita and her mother joined the ashram of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, transforming that fleeting visit into a 7-year journey within the commune, first in Pune, India, and later in the notorious city of Rajneeshpuram in central Oregon. After the fall of Rajneeshpuram in 1985, 16-year-old Sarita was abruptly thrust into the quote-unquote real world. Driven by sheer determination, she navigated her way to university, ultimately graduating from the University of Colorado with a degree in humanities and comparative literature. Following a successful career as a technical writer, she returned to academia to earn a Master's of Science in Oriental Medicine. Now a successful alternative health practitioner and writer with a deep passion for truth and knowledge, Sarita finds solace in nature and engages in creative endeavors, whether through appreciating the arts or expressing herself artistically. She is dedicated to raising awareness about the hidden traumas experienced by children of cults and embraces the healing powers of art and creativity. Sarita currently resides in Boulder, Colorado, and today she is with us. Here's Sarita now. It is so nice to have you on the show. So Sarita Carroll is a really interesting woman who has a really interesting story. And I'm so glad that the listeners are going to be able to hear from you and hear about your perspective. When I ask people what kind of cultic group they've been in, I also let people know that I'm not going to assume, and the reason I'm asking about each person's experience, I'm not going to assume that one person's experience is the same as someone else's, even in the same group, because there's so many factors that lead up to your experience just being yours, really, even though it's going to overlap in some significant ways with other people. But the age that you're in, your family relationship, your nervous system, all of it, you know, it all adds to your experience. And so that's why I really love when people get to get into their experience and also being able to talk about being a second generation member. Because when we talk about healing, a lot of people who had a significant portion of their life outside of a group and then got involved, I use the word more often, like re-entering or reformulating their path. But sometimes for people who were brought in at such a young age, you're doing things for the very first time and developing things for the very first time. And so it is an amazing challenge. I think people don't give it enough credence that it really takes a lot to do that, to do what you've done. So welcome to the show. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you about my story.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad. And so tell us a little bit about you now before we go into the past.
Yeah. So now I live in Boulder, Colorado, and I moved here quite soon after the collapse of Rajneeshpuram, and I stayed, and I currently have my own acupuncture business practice. I also have a real estate license and stuff like that. So,
yeah. That's great. That's really great. And I'm glad that you've been able to start a business. There are a lot of people who go into the healing arts. You know, they need a day job. They need to have an income. But there's also something significant about being able to interact in the world in a healing way, in a way that has more, I guess, what feels like authenticity.
Rather than absolutely.
Right? The magical thinking that you had been involved in. So we'll get into that. So tell us about your story. And I don't want to interrupt the flow of the story, but I might just jump in with a question here and there. And so hope that's okay with you.
Sure. So my story is that I joined the Rajneesh movement when I was 9. And that was in India for 3 years. And then while I was in India, I sort of got pulled into the inner circle and got very indoctrinated into the culture. And I thought I'd be there forever. It was, the part in India was quite celebratory, and it was a small ashram, and I knew everybody. So I felt like I had found a family. And I already had a strained relationship with my mother, so that felt very welcome for me, just sort of having a real sense of belonging. And then that whole community fell apart in India, and it moved to Oregon, which everyone probably, well, not everyone, but a lot of people have heard of Rajneeshpuram. And so at 12 years old, because I was quite connected to the inner circle, I traveled to Oregon on my own and was one of the first people to arrive at the new ranch. And at that point, there was only about 30, 35 of us. And so we were trying to blend in with the cowboys and telling them that we're just coming there to live peacefully and farm the land. And, you know, but then soon droves of people came and all the controversy began.
Right. So you went there on your own. So without your mom.
She came a month later. It was just about money. And so I was so eager to join the commune again because I felt so alienated in the world. I went back to Hawaii with my mom. It was probably only for about 3 weeks. And I was just completely disoriented and deeply depressed, even though I didn't know that word. Because in that community setting, everything was about love and celebration. There wasn't really space for negative feelings or concepts of depression. That would be your shortcoming. And so you tend to suppress a lot of, well, you tend to judge yourself a lot and present a different way.
It's interesting. Almost everyone I talk to, and it's been thousands of people who have been involved in cults, they've all said that there is no space for negative feelings. There's no space for depression. There was no definition of it. Or if it was defined, it was Satan in some groups, and it was that you brought it on, or it's your karma or whatever. It's called a lot of other things. Or your imagination, you're making it up, or you're, especially I think this happens a lot for girls and women, that you're just, you know, being emotional, hysterical, or manipulative.
Or self-centered, right? You're not surrendered. You're not surrendered. You're missing the point.
Oh, wow.
You're not spiritual.
Right. There's so many instances of the adding of insult to injury over and over. And literally here, you know, you're kind of injured by this experience and then you're insulted on top of it.
Yeah, it's a compounding process. And so that's probably why it's taken me this long to speak out. And, you know, I wrote this book that's goes through my whole history in the community, but it took me this long because I had to go to therapy for so long to own my own voice and to find my own truth and sort of weed out all of that conditioning that was so embedded. And it's not like I'm a zombie, you know, I still think for myself, but then there's a sort of little voice that sort of always questions like, well, maybe I really am just so screwed up and maybe I really am making too much of this, or, you know, so all the self-doubt, and it takes a long time to break through that and actually have the strength to stay in the self.
Oh, absolutely. Wow. Very well said. I see this a lot with the people I work with and also with the support groups that I run. People are afraid of taking up too much time. They have to be given permission to keep talking. They think they've overtalked. They think that they've been selfish. They think that they're going to be judged, that they shouldn't have this problem. And if they were more fill in the blank, something positive, then they wouldn't have this problem. You know, they have to be given so much permission and sort of safety nets over and over. But just to get a sense, because I feel like talking it through out loud helps you get perspective. And if you have other people saying, oh, no, that happened to me too. And no, that's not something you did. And that's not selfish. That's this. It's really helpful.
It's really helpful. But the other thing that comes up is you have to learn discernment about who to share with. Because if you choose the wrong people, it's almost worse because you feel overexposed. Or, for example, with me, there's quite a few people from the commune who are beautiful, nice people. But if I share this stuff, the commune speak comes back at me. Or, you know, if it's someone you don't first build some trust with, or maybe in a safe setting of a group that's working on such issues, then suddenly you could feel like, oh my God, I just told them this crazy story and they're looking at me like I have three heads.
You know, I want to get back to your story, but I just want to jump in here too, because on videos that I've made and talks I've given and probably on this podcast too, I've talked about how I don't use the words withholding or resistance with clients for that reason, that I don't want them to feel compelled to share and overshare, especially if they don't know me. I mean, they may have heard my name or they may have heard me speak or whatever else, but they don't know me and they don't know if it's safe to talk to me. So slow it down and don't feel like you have to be overexposed, as you're saying, that's a great term for it, without testing me to see if I'm a safe person to talk to for you, you know? But I know a lot of therapists go into being hurt that you didn't give them what they wanted. So they use the words resist. You're resisting this process or you're withholding information, which is, I think, again, adding insult to previous injury.
The other part that's interesting is because in the community I grew up in, it was all about being very blunt and almost like explosively sharing. And then you're supposed to sort of be total and then move on. And so that oversharing thing came from that. And then you're just like, well, that wasn't safe. And now I sort of collapse into this shame capsule because I'm like, oh gosh, you know, and this was not now, but this was like when I was first coming out, when I was, you know, in my teens and, you know, going through puberty at the same time and having such a huge load of trauma that I didn't know was trauma. And get that this was also like mid 80s and the world of trauma therapy was basically not called that. And there wasn't as many tools or as much understanding. And so all I had was my visceral reality and the racing thoughts in my head.
Okay, so here you are. You come to this new space that you're very excited about, this new ranch. You're there on your own and there are 30, how many people?
I was the 32nd person to arrive. A week later, there would have been 50. You know, it was people were coming really rapidly.
Incredible. Okay, so what was that like?
Well, at the beginning, it was, you know, at first I felt very out of place because the people who were actually there were not the people I knew. Like Sheila and the other, what we called moms, they were in New Jersey or elsewhere in the world. So when things fell apart in India, people went back to their original countries and were waiting desperately to come to the new commune. And so I felt very privileged, but at the same time, I didn't know the people. So at first I felt very awkward. There was only one other kid there. Besides the guy who was the ranch foreman, his two daughters were there, but they were, you know, going to regular school, everything. But I soon found people, and I usually throughout my life, I found one or two people who sort of took me on in a sort of maternal role and always looked out for me. And so I feel thankful for that. And so I met a woman there who took me under her wing and I worked in the kitchen with her and learned to bake, and that brought me joy. But while this was all going on, I am starting to develop into puberty. I'm a prepubescent girl, and this was a very open sexual environment, and it just got more and more like that. It was the same in India. So at that point, I started being groomed by an adult man at age 12. So that's going on.
Wow. How old was this man?
He was 29. And so soon, I lost my virginity. And, you know, it was sort of like the culture expected me to be grown up. And so I played that role to some extent. I mean, I was a silly teen and I covered up sort of the angst I was experiencing. Because again, it was a cultural norm. And the whole notion was like, well, everyone's sleeping with everyone. What's the big deal? You're just part of the culture.
Right, even though you're a child.
Correct.
Right. And so what was that like to sort of have to play this adult role? What did that mean?
Well, I mean, for one, it means, I mean, I was very responsible. I worked along the adults. We did have school now and then at the beginning, but it sort of never came to fruition. And I think, I don't know this for a fact, but I think the powers that be, I mean, soon a lot of Sheila came in, you know, there was more authority present. I think they thought, well, we can just have them work too, because we were all about work. And it was work was called worship. And so that was our devotion. And we were building the city in the desert. So we worked 12 to 16 hours a day. And so I guess I learned to just be, I was, what I say in my book is I was Little Miss Goody Two Shoes, basically. And, but meanwhile, I was suffering more and more because the guy who groomed me and took my virginity, he was sleeping with everybody else. And so at first I was totally enamored thinking this is love. And so I attached. And I think I was so desperate for connection, like real connection, that I just totally attached to him. And so watching him go around and ignore me for the next 4 years was utter
torture.
That
is awful.
And there was no one to talk to about it. Or if you did, I did talk at one point to one of the people in charge, and they were just like, well, then sleep with someone else. And they started setting me up.
No.
Yeah. So you see how complex? It's complex.
It really is complex. And, you know, you were talking before about your voice and really kind of developing your voice. It happens within a cultic system that you don't have a voice. It also happens when you take on that demeanor of or the persona of the goody two shoes. And so it seems like you had it in a multi-layered way.
Yes.
That you learned to just be okay and not say what was really on your mind.
Well, I didn't even know what was really on my mind.
Oh, that's such a good point.
To some extent. But here's mm-hmm. the other part that makes it even more complex is that because I was Miss Goody Two Shoes, and I was sort of favored by the people, the moms, the women who were running the whole show. I wasn't around my peers very much. I worked with them. I lived with them. I was the receptionist, you know, at Sheila's house, you know, hello, Jesus Grove, you know. And so I also didn't have my peer group to bond with. I mean, I did in India and I was still friends with many of them, but it became more and more distant. And so I didn't have that group. So I always felt like I was living in a netherworld. Between mm-hmm. the adults and the children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In between these worlds and really kind of not knowing who you are, I think to a certain degree in either one of them.
Yeah.
Right.
It's more like just this incessant sort of wondering and then just trying to fit in and being obedient. Like, you know, I probably heard a lot of really confidential stuff, but I was so well trained. I mean, to this day, if you tell me a secret, I will not tell anybody, even if you and I had a falling out. It's just, it's so embedded. And so I just observed in a way I felt rather invisible. And I think that's actually something I've had to work through in having a voice is that I actually have a presence because I've often felt like I don't have a presence. I don't have any impact on anything.
Wow. I mean, even the term fitting in, you know, there is something very much about just being sort of one of a puzzle piece. You fit in. And so, you know, you've learned how to fit, how to sort of squeeze into those spaces so that you can just be sort of flat like a puzzle piece and not stand out because people don't want to do that in these environments, but it's safer.
Well, you'd be excommunicated.
Uh-huh.
So if you're negative or if you challenge authority too much,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a little bit so you can complain about little things and you might be a joke, but if you complain about something big, they'll be like, well, Sheila's favorite word was tough titties or shape up or ship out. And so I never challenge authority because, well,
right.
Yeah.
So, right. Yeah. Yeah. Why would you? If this is your family also.
Well, also I wanted their approval because this was, they were, you know, being approved of by them meant I belonged and meant that I was special. And so I was somewhat invested in my special status because it felt safe. I mean, that's what created some level of safety. But then it created alienation from the other peers because I was in this other category.
There are so many visible and invisible hierarchies within
exactly
these, right?
Exactly. There's so many. There's also the spiritual hierarchy within this community. This was sort of the administrative hierarchy. And then there's a spiritual hierarchy, the people that are more spiritual, that were closer to the guru himself. Like his oldest sannyasins were considered more evolved because they'd been in his presence for so long. Because he emitted what was called a Buddha field. And so if you're in his Buddha field energy, just being that energy, he said that you could attain enlightenment. And so there were certain people who had this sort of spiritual sort of persona. And then the people who lived in his house, they were all very attractive women who took care of the cleaning and everything. Those people were also kind of in the spiritual circle. And there was actually a clash between them and then Sheila and the administrative circle. So yeah, there's many hierarchies.
And also when you say, you know, that this is a spiritual realm and the women he had in his house were all attractive, it doesn't feel spiritual suddenly. Like when those things, you know, are really pointed out, that, you know, it shouldn't matter if it really is spiritual. It shouldn't matter what anyone looks like.
No, it was just sort of, I mean, I was pretty innocent at first thinking, God, they're so beautiful. And I actually, well, I remember in India thinking, well, are they beautiful because they're so, you know, seeped in his energy? Like it made me wonder that because they just had this glow about them. And I will say, you know, I'm talking about how I didn't have my own discernment. I need to correct that because I think there was some discernment as I got older. So when I was in Oregon, I started questioning things, but I kept it very much to myself. Because I kept saying, well, this doesn't seem spiritual. Like we're just working and no one's meditating. And what happened to the concept of enlightenment? Because it wasn't coming up. And Osho, Rajneesh, Bhagwan, he's changed his name. He was in isolation for like 3.5 of the 4 years we were there. He was in silence. And so the only time we saw him was when he went for a drive in one of his Rolls Royces. And we all stood along the road and it was like just to be in his presence for 2 seconds was considered a great honor. That was a level of the spiritual contact with the guru. And so I started wondering, like, what is this all about? You know, what's our end goal? Yeah, and it seemed like it became more about power and wealth, especially for Bhagwan. Like his persona became much more grandiose.
Yeah, right. And I used this whole setup to a certain degree as an example when sometimes people ask me what makes a cult different from another group. And one of the things that I talk about is that the followers often live in a very different way than the leader. And so I'll talk about Rajneesh's, what was it, 40 some odd Rolls Royces?
No, 96. 96.
Oh, 96.
He wanted to have 365 so he could have one for every day of the year.
That's so spiritual. So, yeah. And then also with people sleeping on mats or eating rice and beans, and he's living this lavish lifestyle, and somehow that all makes sense. It's not dissimilar from when you see these televangelists who, you know, are on their third or fourth private jet and people are giving over their last welfare check to him, you know. So, I mean, it's not like Rajneesh, you know, created this, but you can see it right in front of you.
But I think, yeah, I mean, of course, being part of it is like, well, no, we're different. You know, we're the chosen ones. And our life was about celebration. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. And we were about joy and creating joy for the world. And I will just give the caveat, the food was actually pretty good. We were kind of, but yeah, we all had 3 people to a room and the mattresses were on the floor. It didn't feel like deprivation, probably because that's what we were used to. You know, like when I think of it as like, well, I had a bed, like, yay, like that. But it's true. Like we didn't have money. most people didn't have money. A lot of very wealthy people were disciples, and they donated millions. And it started getting to the point that, you know, Bhagwan Osho didn't have all the things he wanted. Like, he had million-dollar watches and stuff, and he wanted more. He wanted this new Rolls Royce. And that's what Sheila, his personal secretary, would say was the breaking point for her. That's what she says. I don't know the whole story, of course, because I wasn't there in the room. But she said he became like a petulant child.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. Right. Having kind of tantrums about, you know, I want
wanting
this,
more. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, they needed money to keep building the ranch because it was a very expensive enterprise. And then trying to get more people to come in. And so it actually felt like the whole thing turned into a business. They built the sort of therapy group set up again. And then they would invite people to come for 3 months and work and do the groups, but they would pay a lot of money. And so it started to become like that. And also discotheques are all over Europe and even in Portland and restaurants. And so these were all business enterprises that were sending money back to Oregon, to the ranch.
Wow. He was doing very well. Okay. I'm curious, before you continue on with your story, I'm curious about your mom in this scene. No. So as you were there before she arrived and then she arrived, then what? I know family relationships are not really, they don't matter in cultic groups, but I wonder, yeah, you know, about yours with your mom.
Well, so just to back up a bit, my relationship with my mother was very strained even before we went to India. And my mom would even say that she decided to go to the ashram because I was a troubled child and that she was trying to help me because I was an angry child. And that started very young. My mother and father broke up when I was like 3 months old, and he was a heroin addict. And then my mom was a hippie. And we were moving, I think before I was age 9, I must have lived in 15 places. So we're on the road a lot. And I think that partly is what created, I mean, the thing with my father wasn't good, but then also my mom constantly being on the move, I felt, I think, unsettled, but I didn't have the language, right? And so I would throw huge tantrums. I mean, I was really angry at her from very young, really angry. And she says that she didn't know what to do. And so I often would go off with other people. This is that how that pattern started, where I sort of adopted other mother figures. And so, yeah, I was living in this sort of hippie commune in southern Colorado for a while, and I basically attached to another woman more than her. And so my mom took it all personally. My daughter's rejecting me. That was this thing I had to carry my whole life, because she's always saying I rejected her, and the guilt that comes with that. And then also just, and then the anger compounds, right? Because it's not resolved. And so in a way, when I arrived at the ashram, there were people I didn't have that history with that just adored me. And for me, it was kind of a relief because I didn't know how to relate to my mother. And it felt like we were from different planets. Like, she didn't know how to relate to me either. And so she always thought she was doing these things that would help me. And to me, they were not helpful. They only compounded my rage and my abandonment feelings.
Right. Oh, absolutely right.
Right. Yeah. So here I am just totally feeling abandoned, and then I don't trust her. So then I act out by pushing her away. And then she engages in that because she's like, I'm a powerful little girl. But that's obviously not what I wanted. I wanted her to, it was me testing her boundaries and saying, come in and still sit with me through this and create containment for me. But I was given the freedom. And that was part of the whole 60s spiritual movement, freedom for the children. So she was following that philosophy. And then I would just keep having my tantrums and also just feeling less and less trustful of her. So that's how it began. So then in the commune, we had very little interaction.
And, you know, I mean, not to get too into family therapy here, but
yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it's fine.
Part of my field. And so I can't help but jump in even just briefly. It happens very often that parents, especially parents who have maybe had parents themselves who dictated a lot in their lives, they want to give their children freedom.
Absolutely.
Right. There is, like, it goes generation to generation, kind of a flip back and forth a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And sometimes it goes to an extreme, to the point where a child doesn't feel contained. They don't feel thought of and remembered and taken care of and protected.
Exactly.
But the parent does feel like they're giving you this gift that they didn't get to have. And so finding what works for the child, not just responding to how you were parented, but seeing who's right in front of you and what they need is sort of, I think, the safest way to do it.
I agree with you 100%. What I've seen now that I'm an adult and that I've done a lot of therapy and I could see her more as a human rather than just my mother, I really see the generational trauma. She came from a very strict academic background. Her parents were quite cold, especially her mother was probably the most difficult, strident, and intellectually intelligent person I've ever met. But she could just cut you to slices with her words. That's where my mom came from. Nothing was ever good enough. She was scolded, you know, and also abandoned a lot, I think. And so I see how that played into how she raised me. It doesn't make it better for me, but it does help me to sort of see that she wasn't intentionally trying to hurt me.
Yes, right. Oh, that helps a lot. It helps a lot to know that. It really does.
You know, because I do know that she loves me. It's just sort of like our love can't quite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, got you. Got it. Okay. But you did something really adaptive where you found other mother figures. And that's a really smart thing to do. And there are other people who just presented as safer and maternal and could help guide you, teach you, comfort you, the things that you want.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, another thing we should probably bring up is the education or lack thereof.
Yes, please.
When you said these people were guiding me and stuff, yes, some of them would try to teach me to read and write, but it was quite minimal, but they still looked out for me. But the commune as a whole didn't look out for my education or the other people's education. I mean, in Oregon, we had a school. The younger kids lived there separate from their parents, like in this other town in Antelope. But most of us didn't get proper schooling. Like we had little trial periods for like a month or two, and then we just worked. And we actually devised, well, the powers that be devised a system called School Without Walls. And so basically what it was is we'd work with, as we usually did, but we would get school credit.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so when I left, I actually had a transcript saying I had, you know, done really well in school, but I had never gone to a class.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So, yeah. So that was part of the adapting after Oregon fell apart, was having like basically no education.
Oh my goodness. So here you are, during the time that you were in Oregon, you were with this man, this older...
Well, it was him first, and then... I was sort of on his rotation, I'd say. And then first I was just devoted to him. And then people were saying, well, you should, you know, sleep with other people. You'll get over it. So next thing you know, I'm trying to be seductive. I mean, I was terrible at it, but I thought, okay, I'll try it. Because I was actually quite prudish. So yeah, I ended up letting other men take me to bed. And it probably was 10 to 15 men over that time, which is very little compared to my peers. Many of them had 70 to 150 partners. I wouldn't say partners, men who perpetrated them. I was quite shut down like that because I was still looking for love. I didn't get the point of sex without love. And it was funny because I'm living in a sex cult and I couldn't, maybe that was some part of me that stayed intact. Like I just couldn't go there.
Right. And also looking at this in terms of perspective, to talk about, you know, 10 to 15 people and then say you were shut down in comparison to the people who had more.
right. But still, I mean, in mainstream society, that's not shut down. That would be promiscuous. But from where I stood in that culture, I felt there was something wrong with me. I was shut down. I wasn't, the adults would say, you're not juicy. You didn't let your sexuality blossom. So I had this whole shame thing, like I didn't appreciate my budding body when it was budding because I was so ashamed or I don't even know if it's shame. It's just uncomfortable getting attention. And I did get a lot of attention. I was tall and developed young and, you know, men were constantly after me.
Right. I mean, did the terms like juicy, I mean, that's just groan worthy. It's
disgusting.
It is really horrible. And I think also that to be given some sort of moniker that is critical when you're not wanting to do something that your core is guiding you to feel uncomfortable about, and that there was no space for you to just have that and say, no, this is not what I want.
And that for many of the other children, then children, there was actually this whole thing, like if you were still a virgin, even the other peers, we became adapted to be like, well, that's something's wrong with you. You need to lose your virginity. Like that was a rite of passage. So that was pretty sick. And the ones who didn't, who were just like, I don't want to, were somehow, I wouldn't say ostracized, but kind of thought of as uncool, or that you need to surrender more. You need to open up. You need to let go. So if you're not like let go, which means let men have sex with you, then you are not surrendered. The surrender concept even permeated into the sexuality.
And the boys also growing up there, what was it like for them?
So they too were having sex, and some of them were perpetrated by adult women, but I didn't know as much about their stories until more recently. And it turns out most of them were abused as well. I mean, it turns out that within there's probably maybe 100 kids total in the commune, and maybe 50 of us were teenagers. I would say 90% were sexually abused.
Oh, my goodness.
But some of them don't feel that they were sexually abused because they embraced the experience, right? And sort of were, they say they felt free. And so with the boys, I don't know the exact details except for a couple of them. But I know for me as a teen girl, I had already been pulled in by the adult men. So the teen boys felt to me like they were too young.
Right, right.
It's just so skewed.
Uh-huh, right. Oh, that makes perfect sense though. Yes, absolutely.
And they were mad. They were mad. Like my main perpetrator, his nickname was the rapist because he slept with so many women. So, I mean, his name is in the book, so I can say his name. His Sannyas name is the name we were given by the guru, was Milarepa. So the extension was the rapist. And a lot of the teen boys started calling him Milarepist, and they were mad at the adult men who were sleeping with us teen girls because they were not getting the opportunity to have a relationship with us because we were all fixated on the adult men. Or the adult men were much better players in the realm of sexuality because they were trained. I mean, they've been seducing women for years.
Right. It's also, you know, so often it feels like opposite day in cultic groups where things just should quite be the opposite, that boys, teen boys, being mad at the men for kind of claiming the girls that they could be with and being mad about that makes sense in that context. Outside in the world, the men would be reported.
Be a whole different scene. Yeah.
It would be a whole different scene.
That's the biggest thing there. It's like this behavior was normalized. Mm-hmm. It was just 100% normalized.
Incredible. Incredible. Yeah. Okay. So here you are at this ranch. And then what happened? So I know there was a sequence of events.
So things sort of just got crazier and crazier as the time went on. There was, if people have seen the documentary Wild Wild Country, they'll know that aspect of it, that the conflict with the government and with the city of Antelope and trying to take that over. So that's sort of the political aspect, which is very well captured in that film. I'd have to say it's quite accurate. But it didn't talk about the children. It didn't talk about how hard we all were working and how, you know, how there was no spiritual aspect anymore. But then things just started getting weird. I was actually sent to Europe for 6 months towards the end of the commune. And right before I had left, I was living in Sheila's house. At that point, it was probably like a 15-room house that they had built this compound. So I lived there. Again, I was Miss Goody Two Shoes. I was in the inner circle. And then just out of the blue, she calls me to her room and says, we're sending you to Europe for 6 months. We're doing an exchange program with the communes that had developed in Europe. And I was like, is this good? Is this bad? Am I being sent away? You know, what's going on? I had gone to Europe for 6 months. It was absolutely hellish. I moved to 6 communes within 6 months where I didn't know anybody at each place.
Oh, no.
At this point, I had just turned, I think I was either 15 or 16. And so it was so awful. There was not, I didn't have sex with anybody, which was a nice relief, but I again, the concept of depression and severe depression towards the end and not knowing what it was. And like, I was actually in a sick where I refused to move at the last commune I was in, which was in Amsterdam. So literally 6 communes in 6 months. I go back just in time for the final world festival. We had these annual festivals where 10,000 people would come. I get there and I could tell that things had gone bad. The vibe was notably different. It was like sinister. I could feel this sinister air and people were strange. And I went back to Jesus Grove, which is Sheila's house, and expected to be welcomed back in. It was just sort of like, okay, you can work here again. But I had been moved out. A letter that I had written a letter to my perpetrator, the main one from the beginning, saying, why don't you choose me anymore? I mean, I was this desperate teenager. And he had written me a letter back. That letter was missing from my belongings when I got back. Only later did I learn that some authorities were, you know, sniffing around. And so it made me wonder if I was sent to Europe because my relationship with that particular man was very well known. I don't know that for a fact, but the fact that my letter that he wrote was evidence and it was gone. And then there was like a barbed wire fence around the compound, Sheila's house where I used to live. And everybody seemed much more, the joy was gone. There's no joy. And then suddenly in the middle of the night, all that inner circle left. They all left.
In the middle of the night. You just gotten back and then they're gone.
I've been back maybe a couple months, 3 months.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, 3 months, I think. And so then they all left in the middle of the night, like the main people that I was close to. I can remember the feeling. It was like I couldn't breathe. So everybody that gave me my status and my sense of belonging fled without saying goodbye. And then after that is when all these crimes came to light. Okay, so even the house where I lived in, there was these bunkers underground that I didn't know about. There was the whole wiretapping scheme. There was all the attempted murder, and the poisoning of the salad bar in the Dalles. And I mean, it just went on and on. And these were the people who were my role models. And they were all now criminals.
Oh my goodness. Wow. So you lost everyone. And you had just come back from pretty much, you had just come back from being displaced, you know, over and over again, being with people you didn't know. You get to enjoy being back with people you do know, but just for a short time until they're all gone. And relationships, you think relationships are significant enough where they would prepare you for them leaving or say goodbye, or you would have a way to be in touch with them. But no, it's like they just got ripped away from you.
They were just gone. They had escaped. At first, we didn't even know where they were. I mean, I was close, especially to one woman who was like number 2 or 3 in charge. And she was the one that I'd been close to since India. But I mean, there's more to the story that happened to her. She also got kind of blacklisted by Sheila. So she was not even herself when I had returned from Europe. So that was already, I was already feeling quite lost before everything sort of fell apart. But then shortly after that, so then Bhagwan is speaking at this point. He started speaking at that festival, the last festival. So he's only speaking for a few months. And then he's dissing Sheila, calling her, you know, Hitler or, a fascist, her and her fascist gang, all this stuff. And that we're going to rebuild the commune and all this. So I'm just there waiting, feeling like I don't know where I belong now because I belonged in this subculture of the people in charge and now they're gone. And so he's dissing Sheila and her gang, saying now we're going to fix it all and all this stuff. Meanwhile, the FBI is investigating. And then he flees. He was on his way to Bermuda, I believe. And his new secretary is like, oh, no, we're just taking for a holiday. But he was arrested in Charlotte, North Carolina. And he was charged with immigration fraud because there was like, I think it came up to 500 arranged marriages of American disciples with foreign disciples. And so he claimed his silence all along was his alibi. Like he didn't know anything that was going on because he was in silence. But Sheila would meet with him every night. And she said that everything she did was dictated by him. And so to this day, there are many people who are devoted to him still that think Sheila was the problem and that he's still just pure love and this enlightened being, you know, rare. So for me, it's really hard having gone through all of this and now written a whole book about it to still see all the Osho memes all over the internet, all of his quotes all over the internet in a whole new insurgence of followers.
Right. I've seen that too. I saw that on Facebook. It was very disturbing. And
it's
in fact, someone who knew about cults, but and I contacted her. And I'm just kind of curious. And she had kind of a detached way of thinking about it. Well, if it's wisdom, it's wisdom. And, you know, I want to
see. For me, it's all tainted.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've seen some of those people. It's very interesting these days because there's these people who say some really wise things and have really, you know, interesting sort of perspectives. But I still get so weary because where's the line when they become sort of guru-ish? And there was somebody on a different podcast who mentioned that she liked to listen to Osho discourses or something. And I went ballistic. I mean, I literally called them out publicly. I mean, which is, I just had a moment. That's a trigger, right? That's like PTSD reaction. Like, I can't believe you're on a cult podcast and you're talking about this guru who, you know, who basically condoned through the culture he created through his teachings, the abuse of children. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. You know, at least one aspect is like he created this free love, you know, follow your id, so to speak, follow your id's urges. And then what about the children? Because you're supposed to follow your impulses. And so seeing all these memes is very disturbing to me.
I'm sure it is. And yeah, I see other people being quoted. And I do think that once someone knowingly harms other people, they lose the right to have me respect them or what they say.
Yeah, they could say beautiful words. It's just that then you're looking at their deeper moral standing, and that's in violation with my moral standing. And so therefore, I can't respect their words.
Right.
Because it's not coming from a deep truth.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's hard because then where does someone like me turn to for solace and a spiritual connection when at the deepest level, this is a spiritual betrayal?
Right. Right. And spiritual betrayal is so difficult. It's so difficult. It's so primal. It's where you should have felt the safest and you felt the least safe. And it should never be that way. There are a lot of people who have experienced that. And so I'm wondering here, okay, so I'm imagining suddenly this feeling of this bandage just being yanked off and you're just raw. And what happened next? What did you do after everyone left?
Yeah, so slowly after within a month or something, then Osho, Bhagwan, fled as well. And he came up with the Alford plea and agreed to leave the country on the felony charges against him. So he did an Alford plea, went back to India, agreeing never to come back to America without the permission of the Attorney General. So he went back to the ashram in India eventually after traveling around the world. There I was, 16 years old, estranged from my mother, basically estranged from most of my peers, didn't know what to do. The people I was closest to were gone. And my mom, I think she approached me after a while, and I just was like, no, I'm going to go to Laguna Beach. I had found this other teenager who was not even a close friend. And I sort of, she was going to Laguna Beach. I said, can I come? So my mom did give me $300. I thought was extremely generous, and I didn't want to take it because, again, I thought I was grown up. But I took it. I went to Laguna Beach with this other teen. We basically stayed at this Osho compound, like a meditation center there, where I had to pay $10 a night. And I started looking for work. But I didn't know how to do it because I had worked my whole life. I knew I had a good work ethic. I didn't have the right clothes. I didn't have the right social skills. I didn't have the education. And so I was floundering quickly, very quickly. And many of my peers, especially the people I was really close to, I had three best friends in India, and I wasn't as close to them in Oregon, but they had all turned to sex work. And as I was like hitchhiking around, trying to go for jobs, walking around, you know, downtown for jobs, I'd hitchhike to get there because I had no way to get anywhere. Literally, people would stop on the side of the road asking me if I wanted to make $50 to give them a blowjob. And so I could see very easily how they fell into the sex work just out of mere need to survive. And again, my whole guts were just churning, like I couldn't do it. So at that point, my mom was in Boston. And as much as I sort of liked my distance, I needed her at that time. And so I went to Boston with my last $99. And I lived in a house with her. I insisted that I pay rent. Like I still had to be an adult. It was just my pride, I guess. And I started doing temp work in Boston. In Boston, I could get jobs. I pretended that I had worked in the law firm in Oregon. So I'm like, yeah, I worked in a law firm. So I was doing these temp jobs all over Boston. But then they started asking me, well, what's with you wearing so many orange clothes? And why do you have a strange accent? Because I guess at that point I spoke differently, having been in this isolated environment. And where did you go to high school? You know, all the normal questions people would ask just to be friendly. I was horrified. So I quit and I started cleaning houses. I did that for a while. And then I met my grandparents who lived in Boston. My mom's from Boston. And she had been estranged from them for 10 years.
Oh, so how did you meet them?
Well, I guess she had tried to reach out and she's like, I mean, they were so cold, like they wouldn't even serve her water, you know, at first when she visited. I mean, they were very angry with her and probably also upset about how they were raising me. Although I don't know, I didn't know them. But they knew we were there. And one of my house cleaning jobs, I had to walk right past their house. So my grandpa literally started seeing me and he'd wait and he started inviting me in for lunch.
Oh, okay.
And then he started, you know, they were educators and he just hammered home, like, you need an education. And I'm like, no, that's brainwashing. That's brainwashing. I don't want to be brainwashed. And he finally said, well, just take your GED and see if you can, you know, go to a junior college. And I was like, there's no way I can take a GED. I don't know math very well and blah, blah, blah. Well, I took it and I passed. And the rest is history. I went to a junior college for a year in Boston. And I was like, wow, I'm not dumb. I was like seriously surprised because I was so scared. And then I decided I wanted to move to Colorado just on a whim. I came out here to visit and I just thought it was so beautiful. And so I applied to the University of Colorado and I wrote them this letter about why they should accept me without SAT scores. I wish I had the letter now. I don't remember what I said, but I gave them my transcript, you know, from the junior college and lo and behold, they accepted me. So I kind of managed to get back into mainstream that way. I mean, I had to work my ass off, but I did it. But that doesn't mean that emotionally I had recovered. It just means luckily my age was such that I managed to sort of push and kind of catch up with my peer group in mainstream society. But I still had a lot of trauma and I didn't really realize it until I was, you know, still fighting with my mother and I was still having various struggles, but I didn't take it to be related to the cult until I went to therapy. And suddenly she's like, well, you've been sexually abused. I'm like, what do you mean? You know, and it just started unraveling. And then it kind of, there was a couple events in my life that just sort of, I don't know, sort of set off the whole domino effect. Suddenly I was like, holy cow. And just like very destabilized for a little while.
And do you feel comfortable sharing what some of those things were that were this catalyst?
It was a relationship that was very painful, like with a man and just, again, putting my heart into something and then feeling all that threat coming up again. And that dynamic, like I need him to survive, like totally giving away my power. And so this desperation. And then when we broke up, I felt like I was going to die. I mean, it was very severe, you know. And I wasn't like actively suicidal, but it was sort of like my nervous system went into, I called it hummingbird syndrome. I made that up, but I was so wired that, you know, I wasn't sleeping. I could hardly eat. I had lost, I don't know, 25 pounds. I was skin and bone. It was a huge wake up call. And it's when I realized I had some major issues I had to work on. And before that, I was already doing therapy, but it wasn't, I mean, I never knew that a psychological or PTSD could do that.
Yeah. So there are people who will see me and then, you know, I like for there to be a point where we evaluate how things are going so that they can take a break if they want or they can, you know, sign off if they want. Because of having come out of something where you're there for life, or at least that's what the goal is for you, that I want people to know that they can take a break, that they can see if they still need this or not. And very often what happens is there will be some life event that will let them know, I still have all this programming. I'm still acting this out. I'm still needing something because of my past. I have a lot of attachment issues, a lot of trusting the wrong people, not knowing if you can trust yourself. They're accepting abuse because you don't know it's abuse, and neglect, same. So I will often say, listen, you know where to find me. Something might come up. It might trigger something, but don't worry. It doesn't mean you're going to go backwards. It just means it's this aha moment of, oh, here's this thing that's still under my skin. I need to now deal with it. And I appreciate that I'm being alerted to it. And so now I can address it.
Yeah. It was just interesting because for, I don't know, 10 years or something, I thought, oh, look, I fit in. I bought a house. I have a really good job. I'm fine. And I don't understand why people are seeking spirituality. Like, I didn't get it at all. And then this hit me like a tsunami. I mean, it was so intense when it got stirred. Like, and then you're just there like, what do I do? Because it's, yeah. And then I suddenly understood why people seek solace in spirituality. Because it's like a dark night of the soul is how I'd put it. And then piecing it all together, I guess it was a necessary thing. Yeah. The catalyst was relationships and all the relational trauma. I mean, that's so much relational trauma. And I guess, yeah. But needless to say, I got back on my feet. Yeah.
Yeah, you absolutely did. I'm curious also, and I know there's so much more to your story, and hopefully we can chat again and we can get more into some of the other details. And I know that just the description of you needing to develop social skills, even speaking in a different way, having really been in a whole other environment, like someone who was from a different country or a different planet, and suddenly you're here. How did you take on the social norms? Like, how did you learn them? And did you need to sort of try them on for size and practice them? How did you do it?
I became quite introverted. I think I'm naturally introverted, but maybe I took on more of that than I am naturally. I think part of it was a lot of observation. And I have to say, in college, I did feel very much like an outsider. So I didn't have a lot of friends except for my first real boyfriend, you know, my age and in college. So that was really healing for me. So I hung out with his friends and he actually thought I was cool because I had such an interesting history. So that was nice because I had a lot of imposter syndrome. But I think in college, I caught up partially because I studied so hard. And so I caught up that way academically so that I could then have conversations about, and I could be educated about certain topics. So I pushed myself there. And I think it was only after college that I started working more on interpersonal skills, because I felt like I was just single-pointed on the academics. And I think it helped that I live in Boulder, Colorado, where there's lots of alternative people. And so I didn't feel as weird. But I worked in high tech for 15 years. And, you know, they all thought, oh, she's just sort of the more eccentric hippie chick. You know, so I played that persona really well, sort of this artsy person in tech. And they're all like, really, do you? You don't look like you, that's your kind of work, you know?
Uh-huh, right.
But it worked.
Right, yeah. I can imagine it actually probably feeling good because it's very exact.
Yeah, exactly. And it was safe too. I mean, it was a good, safe job, you know, and very precise. And to be honest, when I left, it was when I had that, I don't want to call it a breakdown, but essentially it was. I was in that tech thinking, I've just got it all together. I've got this great job. I've got a house, you know, the whole thing. And then my trauma hit me like a ton of bricks. And I literally, within a 6-month period, I had gone through a breakup. I had sold my house to move in with this guy. We broke up. I quit my job all within a few months. And so then I had to figure out what next. And that's when I went back to school and put myself back together again, the second time around. And you know what? It's like, it's been so amazing to see I'm capable of so much more than I ever imagined.
That's so good. That's so good. So then you became an acupuncturist. And so tell us about life now, because, you know, yes, you've written, but still, I'm sure there are, just as there are with anyone, there are moments where you see the scars. There are moments where you have your depressive times, you know, resentments, I mean, a lot of things. And so tell us about that.
Yeah. So I feel like things were pretty stabilized for quite a while. And then, and yes, I mean, I think anyone who's has trauma who says they're just totally over it, I don't know if that's the truth. Because I feel like what it is it's just less loud and you have more self-awareness that you don't go there. Like you feel it coming up and you sort of take a moment or you have tools to catch yourself. And that doesn't always work either. And so during the pandemic, this whole topic of my past came back into the fore when someone asked in a Facebook group, a Sanyas Facebook group, Rajneesh's Facebook group, that I wasn't even a member of, but I was on the cover photo. So I joined the group because I wanted the photo. And I went into the group and one of the first posts I saw was someone asking about the neglect and the abuse of children. And so a lot of the people were just not saying much, or there's some of my peers saying, well, I had a great time at the ranch. And I was the first one to come out and say, I was abused. It was disgusting. You guys don't want to, you know, maybe you don't want to see it that way, blah, blah, blah. At that time, I didn't want to name perpetrators because I was terrified. I didn't know legalities and also just what the community would do, you know, as a whole. Just, and already on that little post, there was people saying, oh, well, 14 isn't that old. And, you know, wasn't that just a sign of the times? And so I was, my triggers got totally reawakened. All right. I was just, you know, not sleeping, just rageful. And at that point, I decided to write a letter to my perpetrator, that Milarepa. That I wrote him a long letter and he didn't respond. No surprise. Then about 2 years later, the topic came up again. And me and a couple other peers decided to name names this time. And it was in two Facebook groups. And so it created this sort of huge sort of stirring within that community. And a lot of people were very apologetic, but soon after the sort of initial shock, there was still the same old languaging and dismissal and gaslighting that I had faced all along whenever I brought up this topic. And so that was re-triggering. But that's when I took to writing. I was like, okay, I've been wanting to write this book since I was in college, because I always knew I had a good story. And so I started writing through the whole resurgence. And there was just lots of stuff going on behind the scenes that was quite painful and triggering, like on a daily basis. It all came out, which is, I feel like it's a big part of my journey. And I feel a lot stronger for having done it. And I feel a lot more aligned with myself and just strong. You know, that every minute is strong. But I feel like I've had to go through this crazy journey because trauma is it's a force. It's like a tide. And learning to live with it and knowing, like, there's a lyric, a Ray LaMontagne song. It's like, I've been to hell and back so many times, now it kind of bores me. So, you know, just reminding me of things like that.
That's great, yeah.
And that through it all, here I am. And I've got my scars, and I've got my patterns, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm. It's so nice to hear you say that. I mean, you know, when you study about trauma and trauma treatment and like polyvagal theory, and you learn about Porges, I think his name is Dr. Porges. Talked about that with trauma, you lean in basically towards protection rather than connection. Because in the connection that you have all of these issues, and then you can live an isolated life. As sad as that might feel at times, still you feel safer. And so how do you emerge into the world and make connections and evaluate if a person is safe, or at least feel like you can rely on yourself to keep yourself safe if you realize someone isn't? Like, how did you just do that?
Well, I still have to say I still lean into protection quite often. It's sort of like I have to gain my strength by doing that, and then I can venture out, but I have to have that foundation. And I would say I value my alone time because that is how I can recharge and calm down. And I still wish there was more tools to calm my nervous system. It's like it's been amped for so many years, but I just have to gauge myself. I mean, and also just having all this time that I have found certain people I can really trust and lean into. And there's only a few that are that I'm that trusting of, because, you know, trust is a major issue.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think also with the nervous system, one of the things that keeps it active is feeling like you have to be on high alert.
Right. And so by giving myself that time where I'm not on high alert, where I'm in the safety of my own environment, then I can build up more fortitude to venture out.
Right. Right. I think also knowing too that as you venture out, now you're an adult in the world and you have a voice.
And I have to remind myself of that, but
right.
Sorry to interrupt. But
right.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. That you, because I think what happens, part of what the trauma does is it brings us back to those ages.
Exactly.
And then we think that all these grown-ups out there have power over us. But
yes.
We're a grown-up too. And
I know.
They actually
yeah.
have to listen to us, you know, if we say no, if we say stop, if, you know.
I know. That's been a huge thing because I still have this thing often where I don't feel effective. Like I still feel like I don't have a voice. And so I sometimes feel like I come out a little stronger because I'm so used to fighting for myself. I've always been sort of scrappy, you know?
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. Thank goodness, by the way, that you...
Well, it's a big survival.
That.
I mean,
yeah.
Honestly, my scrappiness probably saved my life.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't give that up. There are steps along the way before you get scrappy, right? Because that was out of necessity, because I think no one
yeah.
would listen if you were just to say something in a subtle...
Well, it's actually learning to be less overreactive.
Uh-huh. Right.
Because that's how I survived. And so learning to have more discernment before reacting is like a huge thing for me. It's like part of my work is to be like, okay, step back. I'm overreacting. Okay, that triggered me. And then I have to, you know, sometimes I still act it out and I'm not proud of that. But there's other times where I'm like, okay, I'm not fully in myself right now and I'm triggered.
So it's reminding me, and I know we need to wrap it up, but it's reminding me of something that I've talked about, which is this idea that I don't remember where I heard it, but it's been really helpful, that very often scary people are scared people.
That's so true.
And that they feel like they have to be on the offense. So they're not on the defense, as though that's the way the world works, because that's the way their world had worked.
They're so scared.
Yeah, right. Right. So like I think about when I learn about wild animals or snakes, the baby snakes have more poisonous venom than the adult snakes, right? And it makes perfect sense.
Right.
You know? Like they feel they need that because of their smaller stature.
Their delicate state, right?
Right. Yeah.
So they need more punch.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so for you that you've had that, thank goodness, and then being able to evaluate when you need to use it and when you don't, when you can try some more subtle things first and you feel like you're not getting through, then you get scrappy.
I think a big part of it for me is like believing myself. And also not shaming my, it's hard when to break the pattern of shame, but to not shame myself that I'm not perfect, that I have trauma. Like, I want to destigmatize that term. It's so stigmatized.
Yeah. Oh,
it is. She's traumatized. It's like, oh, so I, and then the translation in my brain and maybe in other people's brain is, oh, I must be damaged.
Oh, right.
And I've had people even say, oh, well, you're damaged. And I'm like, don't say that to me. Like, that's not kind.
No. No, it's not kind. I think what matters is where you go from it. And exactly as you're saying, I don't know if anyone gets healed. It's like grief. You know, do you ever get totally beyond grief or do you just move through with it?
Exactly.
And so I think it's been really, really wonderful to talk to you and just hear some of your story. Where can people find your book and any other work that you're doing?
Yeah, so you can read more about my story before buying the book at my website, which is just saritocarol.com. So it's called In the Shadow of Enlightenment, because I'm trying to show the dark side of this movement. And so it's available on basically wherever books are sold. Amazon, local bookstore if you request it. The audiobook just came out, which is on Audible and all the online platforms. So,
and if someone's looking for an acupuncturist in Colorado?
Yeah.
Yes.
Or a realtor, yeah.
Or a realtor in Colorado. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They
yes.
can contact you. Okay.
Absolutely.
All
I
right.
so appreciate you having me. It was I felt very heard and seen by you. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It was my pleasure to speak with you. You're a very strong woman. And I know you didn't feel that way for a long time, but you really are. And so it was a pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
One more thing before you go.
It was really important to speak with Sarito. I think it is really an incredible thing. When you hear about people as children who traveled alone to places and were uprooted from their lives and then had to adjust or readjust back into the quote-unquote real world and find their way. And not just survive, but really find a way to thrive. When Sarita was talking about what it was like for her, where she felt like within the group she had found that she had family, or at least felt that she had family, you know, it is so important for everyone to feel that way. And I think there are many people who do miss that. When they have left a cultic experience, they miss the insta-community, the insta-family. And what's very hard, as we've talked about on this show, is the conditional nature of those relationships. You expect that after you've been through so much together, that these will be lifelong bonds. But the cult itself stands squarely between you and those relationships, meaning if you leave it, they need to leave you. And so to find out that belonging to the cult is more important than belonging to each other as friends or family can be really devastating and isolating. Something that Sarita mentioned that I wanted to be able to explore a little bit more was this idea that there was no space for negative feeling. And we hear that all the time. We hear that all the time within cultic groups. We hear that all the time within manipulative relationships. We hear that all the time when people also say they have been involved with someone who has narcissistic personality disorder, where you are not at all supposed to have a negative feeling. It reminded me of a time years ago, and I've hearkened back to this relationship by way of example often, because I just keep thinking of other examples. I was with someone who threw a birthday party for me. It was a significant birthday, and the party was a nice one, a big one. And at the end of it, I knew to say thank you for everything. I also knew that the party was not going to be really what I wanted, but that I was going to need to go along with this other person's wishes for what the evening would look like and be like and who would be invited. I was able to push for a couple of names being added to the guest list, but really it was mostly their friends, mostly their family, with a couple people allowed from my family. And then after many, many thank yous and, oh, I'm so pleased, and fawning really over the gifts that I received, even though they were things that I didn't want, because I didn't want to be in a situation where this person felt that I owed them anything, which is what was going to happen and which is exactly what happened. So I really said, no gifts, please, 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 and then got gifts, which I then needed to appreciate fully or needed to somehow appreciate more than I did. Everything was a test. And so I remember when I was going over the guest list after I had come home from the party, and I just happened to remark, oh, that this person I was expecting didn't come. And I said, oh, it's too bad that so-and-so couldn't make it. I miss seeing her there.
And that was it. How dare you? What is wrong with you? You're so selfish, so unappreciative. That's all you can think about. Meanwhile, that was a tiny little kind of awareness and comment after hours, really hours of showing appreciation and fawning. Over the top fawning. I've never had a party like this. I mean, I had to just sort of really do it over the top. And that was it. I was suddenly this entitled snob is what I was called for focusing on that I had a friend who wasn't there and that's all I was able to think about. And suddenly everything I had said and done to prove my appreciation was gone. And when I think back on that, I think about how much behavior modification was from that scene where I knew not to say a word in any kind of negative way. But then I realized, as I was doing this work with clients, and even as I heard Cerrito speak, that making mention of something that was a truism isn't actually a negative feeling. And it's not being negative, and it's not appreciating all the good things. You're just stating a fact. And so when Cerrito says that there's no space for negative feeling, I really wonder about the word negative. So many people within these scenarios are made to feel that if they are hungry and they make mention of it, or they're eating things that really don't sustain them, and they're, as some people do, they're feeling weak, or they don't have enough protein to be able to sleep comfortably at night, and that whatever else is sort of bothering them, or if they've been mistreated, or if they've been abused or neglected, and they mention it, they're not being negative, they're not complaining, they're not being entitled, they're not being snobs. They're not being unappreciative. They're merely stating a fact. And an emotion, if you say something makes me sad, an emotion can still be a fact for you. So are you being negative, or are you just saying what is? So there are a lot of people who leave cultic groups and are really afraid of accessing those emotions as those are the things that have gotten them in trouble in the past. Somehow those were slights on their whole character. And so I want to encourage people to look at a situation. If you're being told that after you're hurt, if you say, ouch, I don't like that, or I feel hurt by that, or that's unpleasant, or please stop, you are not being negative per se. You're not complaining per se. You are stating a fact. The person controlling you can say how they're unhappy with you. They can say how they want you to be working harder, how they want you to be showing more appreciation, how they think that you're an entitled snob. And I suppose you could turn to them and say, stop being so negative. But I'm sure their response would be, I'm just stating facts as I see them. So if that is only something that applies to the person in charge, that they can say what they want and they can say what they think is true for them, but you can't, then you're going to be relegated to having a lot of your life be just conversations in your head. A lot of your emotions just be chemicals racing through your system that you address and you recognize, but just inside. No one will hear them. No one will know them. And that life is very lonely. So the next time you're called negative and you're thinking, oh, I really shouldn't be negative, but then maybe I'm just saying what is, but the other person doesn't want to hear it. And the other person doesn't want to have to change, and the other person doesn't want to have to take responsibility, then maybe it's okay for me to have these feelings. It just might not be safe to have these feelings with someone who doesn't have the ability to tolerate them and accept them and be kind. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.